Okay, our next matter on calendar today is docket number 65063, Robbins v. State. And counsel, are we ready? All right, Mr. Salmon, if you'll come up.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kerry Sandman, Arizona Federal Public Defender's Office. Gary Guyman is here as my local council representative. I intend to focus most of my time today on the following simple proposition. In light of new evidence, the district court erred when it dismissed Mr. Robbins' habeas petition based on Nevada's procedural bars without affording Mr. Robbins an evidentiary hearing on his claim of actual innocence. The right to a hearing on a gateway innocence claim is established, as this court recently said in the Berry case, when specific factual allegations, if true and not belied by the record, would show that it is more likely than not that no single juror would have found Mr. Robbins guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So what if you find, well, maybe a juror might still find him guilty. Can we still pass through the gateway? And the answer is yes, as long as it's more likely than not.
And back that up just occur. A second.
Yes, sir.
Because you've opined in the beginning about newly discovered evidence. Is this truly newly discovered evidence or evidence that could have been discovered at the time?
The underlying constitutional claim with respect to the discovery of infantile scurvy surely could have been discovered and should have been discovered. We have a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. So absolutely, the evidence could have been discovered because it's right on the x-rays that counsel had in their file in 1988 when they were preparing this case for trial. What I'd like to do is summarize the four factors which demonstrate that Mr. Robbins has indeed earned the right for a hearing on his gateway claim of actual innocence. The first factor is this. There is no reliable medical evidence supporting the conviction. At trial, Dr. Hollander testified there were no innocent explanations for Brittany's injuries or her death. She attributed the death to a homicide due to blunt force trauma. The newly presented medical evidence shows that her testimony was manifestly erroneous, unreliable, and ultimately misleading to the jury. Because we have discovered that Brittany had Barlow's disease, we now know there are innocent explanations for each and every single one of her injuries and her death.
Are you basing your statement on the testimony of the distinguished doctor from Stanford? Is that your position based on his testimony or his affidavit?
I'm basing the conclusion that Brittany had Barlow's disease based on the diagnosis of Dr. Patrick Barnes of Stanford, yes.
Because I noticed in there that he did make a diagnosis as to that disease, possibly scurvy, but said he did not investigate the cause of death, I think, as it's related.
And Dr.
But to the medical degree, certainly the other, yes, but not as to the cause.
He did not opine as to the cause of death because he's not a forensic pathologist. So we turn that over to Dr. Plunkett, who found, based on his examination of the same information that Dr. Hollander looked at, plus the evidence of scurvy, and he found the evidence was insufficient to conclude that this was a homicide. And so, did Dr. Hollander get it right? As we all stand and sit here today, did she get it right? Maybe. But maybe he's not anywhere near proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the cause of death of this child.
But counsel, don't other things contribute to that beyond reasonable doubt determination? And can you tell us why other testimony that was presented at trial that spoke to the manner in which your client allegedly treated this infant should be ignored?
Well, I don't think the court can ignore anything. Under the Berry test, you have to look at all of the old and new evidence collectively together. In the Berry case, for example, You had five eyewitnesses to Mr. Berry's committing a murder. So the court looked at that then in light of all the other evidence. In this case, not only do we know that Dr. Hollander, we can have no confidence that she got it right.
Well, you just said maybe she got it right.
Well, that would be a guess on all of our part. If there are innocent medical
explanations. What do you do with the fact that Dr. Barnes's affidavit is stated to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, but Dr. Plunkett's is not? And neither was Dr. Hollander's, as an interesting aspect of this. Nowhere does she give her opinions, her trial opinions, to that degree either. But is there a problem with Dr. Plunkett's not being stated to a reasonable degree of forensic certainty that Dr. Hollander should not have opined as she did because she missed the evidence of scurvy? Is that a problem for us?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. Dr. Plunkett, I think, has stated his background, his professional experience, and he's drawn certain conclusions that are unequivocal.
Okay, so you're saying it would just be a talismanic addition to his affidavit at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
And the state made no objection to the submission of his affidavit.
Thank you.
But in answer to your question, when you look at the totality of the evidence, when this court decided the direct appeal in Mr. Robbins' case, it found, based on the testimony of certain witnesses, that Brittany had suffered, and I'm quoting, a pattern of unrelenting violence and brutal physical abuse. Now, you match the new medical evidence up against five different evaluations of this child from the period of early February of 1988 through the end of March 1988. That's when these witnesses said that they were witnessing all this violence. And on February 2nd, Detective Sarbaugh found no evidence of abuse. On February 10, child welfare worker Stephanie Brewer found no evidence of abuse. On March 28th through March 5th, when Brittany was in the hospital, the doctors evaluated her specifically for any signs of abuse, including abuse with respect to her leg, and found no evidence of abuse. On March 10th, 1988, Stephanie Brewer, child welfare worker, again examined this child. And found no evidence of abuse. And then when the baby returned...
Wouldn't they, going back to the scurvy argument, how come nobody picked up the chance that she was suffering from scurvy with all these medical visits and hospital visits?
Well, the only person that could have, in theory, I think, would have been the radiologist who read the x-rays on February 28, 1988. And he didn't find it.
And according to Barnes, it was pretty obvious on those radiographs.
It was obvious to him, yes.
But the radiographs by themselves certainly can't make any distinction between accidental as opposed to intentional injuries.
Well, Dr. Barnes noted that, but then said that given the symptoms which this child had, which was the swelling in the leg at the end of January, which is a symptom of the subperiosteal hemorrhage that's forming in the leg. And given the fact that the fracture went through the callus is forming in response to the breakdown of the collagen. That suggests there was one fracture, not the two that were supposed to happen at the trial, but the fact that the fracture went through the callus indicated that fracture was solely the result of scurvy. And that was his opinion, and certainly at this point it's not contradicted by any evidence presented by the state. So we have all of these evaluations of abuse, and they don't find any. And then of the key witnesses, Williams and Johnson and Young, they don't see this child after all of those evaluations are done. We documented that in our briefs. And so then you add to that the fact that now Brittany's mother, who has no motive whatsoever to help Mr. Robbins in this case, has come forward, and her brother, Brittany's uncle, has come forward, and they both have said, particularly the mother has said, that Mr. Robbins did not abuse her child. She said that on April 19th, a few hours after the baby died and she was interrogated, and she was told that Mr. Robbins had been arrested for this crime, and she had every reason, if he had abused her, to say that. And she said, that he had not abused her child.
She did, however, tell the detectives that he played rough with the child, and one might question her ability to discern abuse given the situation or other attendant situations that were found around this child's living conditions with respect to the cast and the condition of that. I mean, not so sure her judgment is particularly reliable.
Well, she was there. You know, whatever we can say about her, she loved her baby.
Mr. Salmon, I just wanted to ask you, I can't remember if you said you wanted to reserve time or not.
I did want to reserve a couple of minutes, yes.
Okay.
They had no furniture in that house. This baby obviously had scurvy way before Mr. Robbins showed up, because at the end of January 1988, right after he moved in, Ms. McDowell's brother noticed bruises with scabs on them on Brittany, which is another singular sign of scurvy. So, yes, I think you're right. I think Ms. McDowell was not had issues. Her baby had Barlow's disease that killed her. But she had no motive to try to protect Mr. Robbins. And she repeatedly said after his arrest that he had not abused the child. And she's come forward now and would tell the hypothetical juror we're trying to analyze in this case that he did not abuse her child, and that she had been, she and her brother both say that they were pressured to change that story for purpose of the trial. So I think when you put all that together, and we know that all the witnesses who testified against Mr. Robbins had motive to try to curry favor with the police, I think that that we have passed that threshold to get a hearing for this man who has been on death row for 28 years. And I think no matter what else we say or what my colleague from the district attorney's office will say, we know that this case went to the jury with the Clark County medical examiner expressing great certainty that she knew what happened to this baby. And we know that that medical examiner did not have the information she needed to make that judgment. And because of that, I think that we need to have a hearing, and I hope that this court will at least allow Mr. Robbins that. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Owens.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County DA's office here on behalf of the state. Just to put things in perspective, we're here on a third state habeas petition that was filed 22 years after issuance of a remitter from direct appeal. The case was tried in 1988. I was still in law school at that time. The law clerk who helped me write our answering brief wasn't even born yet. You will be the fourth set of Nevada Supreme Court justices to have reviewed this case. The trial prosecutors were Brad Jerbick and Rod Burr. And the defense attorneys were Steve Dahl and Bob Thompson. That team of attorneys was able to get this case to trial within 1 year, less than 1 year. And we spent the last 28 years regurgitating that trial.
What do you do with Judge Hicks's finding that much of that delay is not at all due to Mr. Robbins, but rather to Ms. Erickson and her derelictions of professional responsibilities?
Well, Judge Hicks, like every other federal judge that sends the cases back down here, is looking at an entirely different legal standard for exhaustion of state remedies. And it's very liberal. We're in the Ninth Circuit, and as we've seen, they let them come back to exhaust pretty
much anything they want. But the Erickson issue is really troubling in this case. That's what you need to answer.
For me, the Erickson issue is very easy. It was the predominant leading issue in their brief down below. And they quickly realized it was a losing argument, and that's why they moved it to the back of their brief, and they didn't even mention it here in argument. But let me say to you, Patty Erickson, who they have attacked a great deal as being incompetent, Patty Erickson understood that this defendant was not entitled to effective representation by her because she was appointed under the old habeas statutes, NRS 177, that was discretionary.
And no, I think I wasn't clear. You're attributing the long delay to Mr. Robbins, and the problem I have is that the delay, according to Judge Hicks, was due to Ms. Erickson.
I'm attributing the long delay to a justice system that is still regurgitating these same arguments. We had Brady issues and actual innocence issues just a few years ago here on the second state habeas petition, and it was denied at that time, and everyone thought, well, it's finally we're done. But no, they're back here on a third with scurvy, just when I think I've heard it all. I've been doing this a while. I've never heard of scurvy. Who knows what they're going to come up with in 5-6 years when they come back on a fourth state habeas petition. I'm just saying there has to be an end to it, and I want to put things in perspective that this delay doesn't get us any closer. This eternal review doesn't get us any closer to discovering the truth and the actual innocence of someone. Let's talk about scurvy. That's the basis of their claim of innocence here. I just have a difficult time. They write this out on paper, and I guess it makes sense to appellate attorneys in the legal context, but in front of a jury, to tell this jury that not only did this man torture and beat and kick and throw and drop this 11-month-old baby around, but they also, between the defendant and the mother, they starved this little child, deprived her of the valuable nutrients she would need to have strong bones to withstand the beatings. It was a mercy that she had scurvy and passed away when she did, rather than have to endure this torture that he was putting her through. How is this going to sound to a jury when they come in with this torture argument? I don't know that if there were to be a retrial, any defense attorney would actually put forward evidence of scurvy. Not only did we beat her, but we malnourished her. I mean, that works to my favor. I mean, that's an aggravating factor from what I can see. That makes a jury more inclined to impose the death penalty. We look at Dr. Plunkett. It's what he doesn't say. And if you look, he did two or three different reports, continuing to narrow his focus and state what his opinion was here, specifically about scurvy. And we've accepted all those allegations as true. Every doctor who looked at Brittany missed scurvy. We're accepting that for purposes of argument here today. They had a forensic pathologist in 1988 who they didn't even put on the stand in trial because their pathologist agreed with the coroner in this case. They all missed scurvy, and some radiologists have been able to look at the x-rays 28 years later and determine scurvy. But so what? I say so what with scurvy? All that doctor says is that she had scurvy, and that aggravated a closed head injury. Their Dr. Plunkett agrees with our coroner that this baby died from a closed head injury that caused the brain swelling, and in a normal, healthy child probably would not have resulted in death.
But what you're asking us to do is become fact finders. I mean, why not have an evidentiary hearing so that we've got a record of exactly what you're saying? And I know you're a good attorney, and you could probably persuade the judge that the scurvy is not a real issue. But here, you're trying to make us be fact finders. Why does the district attorney's office object to these evidentiary hearings in district court?
I'm always encouraging the court not to engage in fact finding. That's a favorite line of mine that I throw into the briefs all the time. Evidentiary hearings are discouraged under the law, and I think the litigants get the impression from this court that evidentiary hearings are preferred, and that is the send-all or the end-all solution to everything. We're going to solve everything by sending it back to resolve a factual dispute. You don't get to an evidentiary hearing unless you pass the test, which requires a legal issue. And the legal issue before you is whether accepting the facts as true, not belied by the record, would they entitle them to relief? But would the outcome of the case have been different? That's a legal threshold standing. Have they alleged enough to even get the evidentiary hearing? And that's why I'm here today. We're not going to avoid that legal issue by doing an evidentiary hearing.
But you made a good argument for the appellant in this matter by saying that they got to trial within a year. It's my understanding, and Phil Cohn's here, that the public defender's office and the special public defender would like 3 years on death penalty cases to be able to prepare. And what I'm amazed as a former defense attorney, former public defender, former special public defender, is the ability of the federal public defender to find mitigation on cases, you know, years later, that trial attorneys who were not always the best in the 80s and the 90s, including myself, who did these death penalty cases, they're able to find these mitigation that we always missed. So that's why the evidentiary hearing is so important, as far as I'm concerned, as a district judge.
It's taken 6 years to get a murder case to trial, and we're backed up because of the supposed need to continually investigate these cases, and this court has reversed some death penalty cases because they've discovered some new mitigation evidence that this court was sure would have resulted in a different result if it had been presented to the jury. And yet we go back in, we retry it with that new evidence, and we still get the death penalty.
And that's the way it should be then. I mean, that's justice is what you're talking about. But without an evidentiary hearing, you're asking this court to determine about scurvy. And the only thing I know about scurvy is my mother, may she rest in peace, had scurvy when she was a little girl. But I never really got into it as to what scurvy is. I have no idea. I'm not the greatest doctor in the world. I spend a lot of time with doctors now that I'm 71 years old, but I still don't know about scurvy. So I would like a district judge and expert witness, so that I have a record to be able to read all this.
Mr. Owens, if I can make a call, yes. I think scurvy is what a vitamin C deficiency, or I thought was cured in the 18th century or something when they discovered it.
That's my
that fruit or whatever, I think.
I've never had it.
I don't know about Justice Sherry's mother. I never heard of it either. But anyway, well, I'm sorry to make light. The point that I'm concerned about, where I agree with Justice Sherry, is I've done a couple of these murder by child abuse trials in district court, and they're tough. I mean, they're hard to prove. There's different issues that could have caused them. I just remember they're probably the most difficult case to do. With that in mind, does it really hurt to have an evidentiary hearing? I mean, the man got the death penalty. Just as Sherry reminds me, death is different. Wouldn't that be maybe a prudent course to follow in this particular case?
Well, I think it does hurt. I think it hurts the system. I think it hurts the integrity of the finality of our convictions. It hurts the families of the murder victims to see their cases still being discussed, applying today's standards, today's laws, to what the attorneys did in the 1988s. The jury and the Supreme Court that reviewed that direct appeal found overwhelming evidence of torture and murder in this case and affirmed, and now we're going to continue to... There has to be an end at some point. There needs to be some finality, even if for a death penalty case.
Mr. Owens, with the broken leg was argued as evidence on the torture aggravator, correct?
Yes.
And Dr. Barnes's affidavit, if I accept it as true, and I don't know whether I should or shouldn't, but it appears reasonable. He says that leg injury was a spontaneous injury that occurred as a result of scurvy, the indicia of which are shown on the radiographic evidence from 1988. So the leg should not have been argued as torture, at minimum. What do I do with that as a reviewing judge tasked with seeing if he has made a sufficient showing of actual innocence to get a gateway open to his constitutional claims despite the time bars? And I'm very sympathetic, although my comments about Erickson may not have indicated that to you, with the problem with these long delays. But I don't know what to do with that in this case. It's very troubling to me.
Well, actually,
there was only the one aggravator, torture.
Yeah, torture. And
I mean, it's a horrible aggravator.
The evidence of torture is him holding the baby over his head and dropping the baby repeatedly.
But the leg injury. Focus on the leg injury with me for a moment.
Well, there was a dozen different injuries to this baby, more than a dozen. The leg injury.
But you would agree with me that Dr. Barnes's affidavit takes the leg injury out of the torture equation if I credit it as true, which I'm obligated to do since there was no evidentiary hearing.
A leg injury is but one of a multitude of injuries and was not a cause of death for the murder.
I understand that, but listen, it does take it out as part of the torture puzzle.
I don't know that it takes it out.
If I credit Dr. Barnes' affidavit, it does, doesn't it?
Her leg was broken. He disputes whether or not it was broken twice.
I think he says, and maybe I misread it. Fair enough if that's how you read his affidavit.
My understanding is the leg was definitely broken. That's why she was in a body cast. And the doctors at the time said that the callus was an indication of a previous breaking,
right,
even earlier than that. And that's his February, and she died in April.
I understood his affidavit to say the leg break was a spontaneous fracture attributable to scurvy and that he stated that to a reasonable degree of medical certainty. Maybe I misread the affidavit.
The affidavits are real critical, and I encourage the court to go look at the actual verbiage the doctors use, because we're both stating different parts of those records. My indication is that both doctors of theirs talk about the spontaneous breaking of a leg and spontaneous death from scurvy. They don't make that as a diagnosis in this case. they say that scurvy can cause spontaneous death. Scurvy can cause spontaneous breakage of the bones. Those aren't the facts that we have here. Brittany wasn't found in bed the next morning and died unexpectedly, like sudden infant death syndrome. She died after the defendant woke her up at 2 a.m. because he doesn't like the baby disrupting his sleep pattern. He likes to sleep in the morning, so he wakes her up at 2 in the morning to keep her awake, to deprive her of sleep, grabs her face, shakes it back and forth to stop her from crying, lays on top of her, and we know from all the testimony that he minimizes. He admitted much of what was done to that child, but he minimized it every step of the way. Instead of putting her on the 6-foot shelf in the closet and listening to her fall down to the ground, he claims it was a shelf 3 inches off the ground. So he admits to everything, he just minimizes it. The only thing that we know of what happened to that baby in that room was based on his testimony of laying on top of that child and shaking the child.
Mr. Owens, if we go back to your premise that we need to look at this from the legal standard, and we take out the difficult suggestion that scurvy was the cause here, because I think we've all indicated that it's something not familiar. What then, in your argument about how long do we let this go, how many successive petitions do we allow to happen, what other condition, I mean, an actual innocence claim is pretty important.
Sure. And they came in and said scurvy is a superseding cause, that irrespective of any abuse that may have occurred to her, scurvy supersedes that and breaks that causal connection, then we would need to have an evidentiary hearing.
So on that point, Mr. Owens, my understanding of Dr. Plunkett's testimony at 4436 of the record is this statement. While Plunkett says that the cause of death was a closed head injury, he then says, quote, however, it also appears that scurvy was a significant and required causative factor. Now, when I read that statement, it was concerning to me that the cause of death may have been scurvy. Without scurvy, the closed head injury would not have caused the death of the child.
Right.
Could you comment on that?
What I learned in law school was that you take your victim as you find them. In tort law, it's called that eggshell or thin skull rule.
Sure.
And if she had scurvy and would not have died but for the scurvy, I'm embracing that. I accept that as true, and I say, so what? It doesn't change the causation argument that he's still responsible for that closed head injury. And even if the coroner's 28 years later can't determine that it was child abuse, the jurors heard ample evidence and words from his own mouth that show that he was inflicting these closed-headed injuries. And
so this goes to your earlier point that had it been known at trial that the child had scurvy, that actually would have caused the jury to arrive at the same conclusion because it would have increased the likelihood of that determination.
That's my assessment. It's not only not exonerating, I think it's incriminating. I think it would be damning to put that in front of a jury. I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Appreciate your argument.
I'd like to read from Dr. Barnes' declaration in response to your question. I think you read it correctly. He says, and I quote, Brittany had scurvy. The scurvy resulted in a subperiosteal hemorrhage, which produced a large callus and ultimately caused the fracture to Brittany's right femur. The large callus formation evident in radiographic images of Brittany's right leg was caused by scurvy, and it was not a callus formed in response to an earlier fracture to the leg. Regarding Dr. Plunkett, Dr. Plunkett found no evidence this was a homicide. If he and Dr. Barnes are doing the post-mortem on this, there's never even an indictment in this case. At this point, when we're evaluating whether we go through the actual innocence gateway, we know Dr. Hollander's testimony is riddled with mistakes, and we know that Dr. Plunkett doesn't find evidence of homicide.
But what about what Mr. Owens said about what Robin's activities were with the child? What about that, what he said? I mean, that sounds pretty damaging.
I mean,
even to me.
He goes into the baby's room, and he says that he's not laying on top of her. He's a 19-year-old kid. And every night, for example, in the mom's statement at the police station, she was in there, woke up the baby at 1 o'clock. Then he went in there and played with her for a while. And he says he was laid over her, but he was on his elbows. And he wiggled her face. And he didn't do anything to abuse her. He didn't say he did anything to abuse her. He didn't do anything to
there's
kill her.
Evidence, the mother was in the there's next enough room. Evidence in this record to show that he caused the injury that caused the swelling that caused the death. What do you say to in response to Mr. Owen's comments at the close of his argument here today that the presence or absence of scurvy wouldn't have made a difference? That's really what the test is on actual innocence here.
It would have made a difference because
also
because it's unequivocal that the break in the leg was caused by scurvy. And I'm quoting now from Dr. Plunkett, who says,
let's focus on the cause of death.
I am. And Dr. Plunkett cannot find any evidence of homicide. And he says, I cannot rule out the possibility that Brittany did not suffer a closed head injury at all, because the assumption here, of course, is that she had one. And he says, I quote, I cannot rule out the possibility that Brittany did not have a closed injury. After all, as I noted, left untreated, scurvy can result in sudden death induced by subdural hemorrhaging and cerebral edema. There's no testimony here from any expert as to the reliable expert testimony as to cause of death. When you take Dr. Hollander out of the equation, which I think you have to because of the errors in her testimony.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions? All right. Thank you both for your presentations and your briefings in this matter. It'll stand submitted.